Okay, for those of you on tape, I'm sorry I left out the introduction, but you didn't miss really anything important. A month ago, or so ago, I was rereading some portions of Abandonment to Divine Providence. How many of you are familiar with that book? I highly recommend it. It's a classic by a man named Jean-Pierre de Caussade. And he talks about how to live your life in a way that you can trust that God is in everything. And I've read it before, and I came across this section, which I did, some of you probably might have already read because I did post it on my blog, but when I read it, it struck home to me in a very deep way because it put some words around I'll read it and then I'll tell you. Souls who walk in the light sing the hymns of light, and those who walk in the shadows chant the hymns of darkness. Each must be allowed to sing through to the end the words and melody which God has given him. Nothing must be changed in what he has composed. Every drop of distress, bitter as gall though it may be, must be allowed to flow, no matter what its effect on us. It was the same for Jeremiah and Ezekiel. They found consolation only in continuing their laments. Had their tears been halted, we should have lost the loveliest passages in Scripture. And that really helped me because I felt like it described something about my life that I haven't had the words to describe. And that is that I feel like God's given me many hymns of darkness, as he said in that passage, to sing in the course of my life. And just to clarify, he's talking about God-given hymns of darkness, which is very different than Satan's discordant songs that he tries to sing to us. So it's not something from the enemy, but there are things that we go through that God gives us that he wants us to sing through to the end. And as Kosad said, some of the loveliest passages in Scripture would be lost if they hadn't been followed through to the complete end. And I've also had hymns of light in my life, which are easier to sing about, but tonight I just want to talk to you about a major hymn of darkness. But first I want to tell you about a hymn of light, because it happened right before this incident I'm going to talk about. I have five younger brothers. The third brother, five years ago, he's diabetic, and he was talking to me about how his kidney was failing. And so after I got off the phone that he needed a kidney transplant, I talked to our superior at that time and said I really would like to be able to donate a kidney to him. And she said yes, so I was really happy about this because he said he probably had 5 years if he didn't have, and I'm 60, he's 5 years younger than I am, so he was 50 at that time. And and okay, I'm going to make a plug here for organ donation. Because all it cost me was a lot of medical tests to make sure that I was in superb health. And before everyone, I would say, oh God, please let them say I'm okay. And 6 weeks of recovery. And I was able to give him, as the doctor said, a pristine kidney. And you know, it really was an experience of realizing how much God wants to give us life, because the desire in me to give him life was so strong. And I mean, I trusted God that he would do whatever he wanted. But so on February 27th, 2006, I was able to donate a kidney to him. And as he says, I saved his life, and I'd do it again. I forget that I only have one kidney, and except when I forget something and then I blame it on kidney loss instead of whatever else. So anyway, so I was recovering from that, a month to the day after I had the surgery, I was going to get up the next morning. It was Sunday night, and I was going to get up the next morning for prayer because I hadn't been going to prayers because I was trying to recover my strength again. And but I hadn't slept well, so I slept in, and Sister Stacy, I believe it was, came up and woke me up out of a dead sleep at 7 in the morning and said, your stepmother's on the phone. And of course, my first thought it was my dad because he's in his 80s. And I got on the phone, and she told me that someone had found my brother Tim, who was the second of my brothers, dead from a gunshot wound. Apparently he had taken his life. And I cannot tell you the shock. I don't know if any of you other, well, I know Mary's dealt with this, but it's just like, you know, no one had any idea that he was suffering from anything. And, you know, it's amazing, if any of you have heard shocking news, it's amazing how your body responds faster than your mind. I mean, my heart started palpitating. I thought, I'm sitting there going, am I having a heart attack? It's like, we really are, you know, all one, body, mind, heart, and soul. And, you know, I wasn't comprehending what was going on other than this is, I can't believe what she's telling me. And so I went downstairs. I was upstairs, and of course they're wondering what the phone call was, and I just started sobbing, you know. I mean, I've never cried like that. Wailing might be a term for it, for an hour and a half straight. And the different sisters took turns holding me. I'd say that's what they did, you know. And I have to say, you know, Job's friends did one thing right in all the course of the book, and that was the time that they sat with him in silence. And that's exactly what I experienced for my sisters. They were just there letting me grieve. My brother was 53, 2.5 years younger than me. My mom had a hard time conceiving, but once she did, it was me. And then 11 months later, my brother Bart, and then 2.5 years later, my brother Tim. His name was Tim. And he'd been living in his dream spot. He loved to hunt and fish, and he had gotten this through where he worked. He was able to house sit for some people who had a house on the lake right on the edge of a forest, and they only used the house 2 weeks a year. So he just had this great place, you know, to live. And of course, in retrospect, you can figure out what was probably going on, but there really was no warning that he had, even among his friends. He was one of those guys who, the way I would describe it is, he gave what he couldn't receive. So he gave a lot of love, but obviously was missing something in his own life. And the last time I'd seen him was actually at the hospital. He had driven over to Grand Rapids. He lived up by Claire. I was on the phone when he got there, but he walked in with two red roses, one for my brother and one for myself, and you know, gave me a kiss on the cheek and said, I love you. And I thought, you know, he doesn't quite seem normal, but you chalk it up to being in a hospital with a sister who's in pain, you know, what's he supposed to do because she's, you know, suffering from having just given part of her body away. And anyway, as I said, it's just hard to express the shock of this kind of news. I've had other shocking news in my life. Another brother had died in a car accident 20 years before at the age of 24, and when I was freshman in college, the guy I was dating was killed in a car accident on his way home. I mean, I have lots of these stories in my life, but this one's just very different because it's not just the death, but it's the manner in which the death happened. You know, not only had he violently killed himself, but he also hadn't been found for 10 days. So that was another whole piece of it. And I'm not trying to gross you out, but I feel like from the beginning, I thought, this is a subject that doesn't get talked about, and that people don't talk about suicides in their family. Understandably, I'm not making any judgment on anybody, but it's one of the things I felt like God wanted me to share about, how he met me in the middle of this terrible, terrible situation. So, anyway, as I was saying, it's odd how your mind, too, goes on different levels. You know, I'm just sobbing, sobbing, sobbing. And it's funny, one of the first things I thought was, I couldn't give him life. You know, I could give my brother Rod life by giving him my kidney, but I couldn't give him life. And I'm crying for the pain that he must have been in, that nobody knew about. And all of a sudden, you know, And I live, my sisters can tell you, I don't live my life on the level that I'm going to be sharing about with this, a lot of experience of the Lord. I think for about a month there, God in his mercy opened a window into heaven. You know, there are, you know, how do you want to put this? There are so many things that are happening on the spiritual level that we're not even aware of. I think we all know that in faith. And there are times when God just kind of opens the window and you see the reality of what's going on. And I felt like that happened to me. He allowed me for about a month to see really the spiritual reality about this. And I want to share that with you because it's important for you to know when you walk through your own traumas that there is another reality happening. So what happened there, just in those first few minutes when I was sobbing so hard, was I all of a sudden I could just see in my mind, see Christ weeping. And at first I thought, you know, what you would expect is Christ is weeping for me. That would be something nice I would make up. But what I experienced was Christ was weeping for my brother, for his pain. Not because, oh no, you know, he did this and he's a lost child, but because he all along has been weeping for my brother's pain, for all that, for his loneliness, for his despair. And what I felt like was I was joining Christ in his weeping. It was an odd kind of comfort, you know, but more comfort than I could even have looked for. And that really became a great source of comfort for me because the impression I had was he was with them all through this. It wasn't a distance. Christ was not at a distance. But even if my brother was not aware of his love, he was with him in it. So I'd say for the whole year before my brother Tim died, I had been meditating on one of the mysteries in the life of Christ, which is Christ's descent into hell. And before I started, the reason I started meditating on it actually was because I was getting interested in iconography and icons. And this is a big icon in the Eastern Church. For Easter, it's Christ descending into hell. The doors are broken of hell and Jesus is reaching down and picking up the hands of Adam and Eve. And I'd been meditating on it. This is how God prepares us, and we don't know where he's going with it. But anyway, I was meditating a lot on that. In fact, the night before I found out about my brother, I had emailed a passage from a book I had been reading to my spiritual director. And just interesting, you know. It's a book by Dr. Regis Martin, and I don't even know if it's in print. It's a short little book. I don't know how it ended up in our library. I'm the librarian. It's one of those books that, you know, about as thin as this. And somehow I had pulled it off. And he did his doctor. He's a professor at Steubenville, at Franciscan University. And he had done his doctorate dissertation on Christ's descent into hell. And the things that had struck me about it was he was talking about and quoting from different catechisms and that about how it's more than just Christ descending into the physical place of hell, but Christ descending into our hell, into our hopelessness, into our despair, into our loneliness, into our fears. And, you know, I just found that very profound to meditate on. And then, you know, in the midst of my brother's own hell and this experience of Christ weeping, I thought that's the reality that my Lord was with him in his hell. He wasn't alone in it. You understand what I'm saying? So whether my brother was aware of it or not, he was. And my spiritual director emailed me back that day and he said, "I just learned of the death of your brother. I'm so very sorry. As you know, I have been pondering the mysterious, inscrutable mercy of God who is love himself. Only the merciful God can truly read the limits, weakness, and pain of the human heart that can lead one to such a thing. His special love and identification with the poor and those who suffer fills me with hope that his judgment will be like he is, kind and merciful, for he knows our frame. He remembers that we are dust. The words you sent me yesterday about Jesus' descent are so appropriate. You know, the Catechism talks so clearly about God's heart and mind towards those who commit suicide that, you know, there's a mitigation because of the pain that they may be going through or the mental illness, all those things. So, and as I, you know, as I said, I've survived many losses in my life, but I've never walked through one like this before. So I want to just share some more about the walk after that time. It was the beginning of many sleepless nights. Any of you who have grieved a deep loss of someone know that you go to sleep and you wake up in the middle of the night and you don't want to wake up really because you don't want to find that what you, that reality is really true. And but again, it was a time of deep, in the midst of deep pain, it was a time of great presence of the Lord. And that first night, it was interesting because I felt like what God wanted me to do was to go to the passage of Martha and Mary, which, you know, we're all familiar with, and Lazarus. And it was, you know, just, how would I say it? You know, Lord, the one whom you love is ill, and he said he doesn't come, you know, and here my brother, their brother died, my brother died. I really felt like it wasn't just a reading. I felt like I was living in this passage. And Mary and Martha knew what I was going through. And but the part that really hit me, besides all those other ones, that what Mary's response was, which was when Jesus got there, she fell at his feet and worshiped. And there was just a grace given to me at that time. God gives different graces at different times, at different ones of us, but for me to fall at his feet and worship and say, I don't understand this. I don't get it. And part of the reason, this is another interesting thing, is about a week before I found out about my brother's death, a priest friend had asked me to start interceding for someone that he was counseling who was suicidal. And so I felt like I was supposed to do that, so I just started praying, you know. And then I find out my brother commits suicide. And, you know, your mind can go lots of different ways. And one of the ways it was going to start to go was, how come you didn't tell me about my brother? And that moment, that night, it was like there was a grace given to not have to ask, to just trust that of course he could have shown me. There's a mystery here. There are mysteries in our life that we just can't quite get past sometimes, and that I just had to abandon that. A number of people had been telling me that day and the next couple days that Mary was supposed to have a very special place in all this. And in fact, one person came up and says, I don't even have a relationship with Mary. I wish I did, but I feel like you're supposed to stay close to Mary. And so I have this icon that I really took with me almost everywhere that I went. I know it's small. I'll put it in across the hall so you can look at it later. But it's Mary, and Jesus is like this around her. And I kept saying, just put me right there between you and Jesus. I just need to be right there. My own mother had passed away already, and I just really needed a mother right then. And so the second night after I found out my brother died, it was a repeat. I try to go to sleep. Of course, I was exhausted. I wake up. And that night, you know, I immediately turned to her, and I felt like I was supposed to go to the Book of Lamentations. And that's where the title of this talk comes from, because it's a story. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. It's written by Jeremiah, who has been described as knowing more about grief than anyone else in the Old Testament. If you read his life, it was not what would be the easy life. And I just kept hitting these verses, like, she weeps bitterly in the night, tears on her cheeks. Look and see if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was wrought upon me. He has left me stunned, faint all the day long. Hear how I groan, there's no one to comfort me. And, just over and over and over. And I felt like Mary was right there with me. And I couldn't help thinking of Christ and his heart. I thought, I only had this one grief to handle. How does he handle all the griefs and pain of the world? You know, just that day before, having that little window into his grieving for my brother, and that was just my brother. In fact, I remember asking my spiritual director sometime shortly after that, how does Christ do it? And he said, well, his heart broke. You know, that's what happened to him. So, but if you're familiar, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but about 3.5 chapters of this, there's this remarkable set of verses that go, but, the big but this I will call to mind, or this I will tell my heart, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And I knew that Mary, as my mother, wanted to teach me to sing that song in the midst of this. So I just had to say yes, you know, to that. It wasn't the kind of mothering I expected, again, but... another provision from the Lord was a couple weeks before I found out about my brother's death. I ordered this book, which I'll put out there. It's called A Sacred Sorrow. It's written by Michael Card, who is a Christian songwriter and writer as well. And it came like 2 days or 3 days after my brother. I found out about my brother's death. He actually died on St. Patrick's Day. So his anniversary is in a couple days. And the subtitle is Reaching Out to God in the Lost Language of Lament. And he is writing from a Protestant perspective, so we don't quite have this same... We don't have this trouble to the same extent in the Catholic Church, but he's talking about how many Protestant churches you feel like you have to leave your griefs at the door and walk in and, you know, praise God, and there's no place for lament. And so he goes through Job and Jeremiah and David and Jesus. He leaves out Mary, which, you know, I'm going to write him about, because there's no reason why he couldn't leave her out, and she lamented. I just reread it this last month. And if you look at Job, lament, the way he would describe it, is struggling through your grief, struggling, sometimes wrestling with God through it, through the pain, until you get to him. And he goes through, as I said, different examples. And if you look at Job, he didn't let go. He kept struggling with God about, and he had so, I mean, you know, I don't need to tell you all that happened to Job, but... As Michael Card says, he stayed on the dance floor with God. And somewhere in the struggle, something does happen if you don't give up. And Job's biggest problem were his friends, because they kept trying to engage him in dialogue and talk about what was going on rather than helping him stay on the dance floor with the Lord. And when Job finally got back on there and really was lamenting, he did find God. He didn't find the answer he wanted, but he found God. And Michael Card, in his book, talks about how if there are like a third of the Psalms, at least, are Psalms of lament. And they all have the same pattern, which they start out, if you look at Psalm 13, which says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long, prayed this one a lot, how long must I bear pain in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all the day? They all start out that way, very honest. You know, some of them are, you know, I hate my enemies, whatever, whatever, but they all hit this one point where there's this one little word, which in Hebrew it's called vav or wav, wow. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but it's that but word, but. And actually, the word itself looks like a tiny pole with a little flag on the end of it. So it's sort of like this little flag that comes up. But, and every lament will get to that part if you just stay on the dance floor and stay in the struggle. And Michael says, you know, sometimes it's simply a matter of exhaustion. You know, you just, it's like having a little kid, you know, that you just, you're holding, they're struggling with you, you know, and finally they just give up because they're so tired and that turns the corner. Or you've cried so hard that you just give up and it turns the corner. Or sometimes, you know, it's just, you just realize it. And I want to say this to you because I think it's important for all of us to learn to lament when we need to lament. And it might be big things, it might be small things, but it's easy to feel like I just need to shove that aside. Or I've dealt with that too long. I'm dealing with one in my life, actually, for the last 3 years that's not done yet. I'll share a little bit with you about that after. But when these kind of things happen, there can be a lot of pressure to act a certain way or reach a certain spiritual place. And you got, if you're going to be a good friend to somebody, you got to let them be out there in that lament as long as they need to be. And sometimes it doesn't look pretty. But if they're seeking the Lord, then you don't need to worry about it. So I wanted to say that. So that's what was happening to me, I think, was lamentation and that hymn of darkness. That sometimes, I was listening to this song with Sister Sarah today. It's written by a friend of mine. She wrote it for 911, and the name of the song is "There Are No Words." The first line of the song is "There are no words, and there is no song," and that's how you feel sometimes. I just can't even put words around my grief. I just need to grieve. And so, some other strains in my lament. The third day after I found out about my brother, I was really afraid of being alone. Everybody had to go off to work, and I was just, and I like to be alone. If you ask people that live with me, I'm a melancholic. My secondary temperament is melancholic, and I need time alone. And I was really afraid of being alone that day, and I didn't know what to do about it. And but God in his mercy provided me with people all that day. It was just one of those times where you just, like Diane Hudzik, is she here tonight? I don't know if she is, but she stopped by at one point. She got out of her Jeep. She walked up to me with 2 dozen white roses, stuck it in my hand, gave me a hug and walked away. And that was just, I mean, I'd hardly knew her at the point, you know. Anyway, it was just a time of God. God really provided, and it was the right people who knew just to be with me and not have to try and figure me out. So one of the things I really wrestled with, and I don't know if I'm done wrestling with it, but because it came up again last year, it came up on my brother's anniversary, was the whole idea of the violence of his death. And it just was, because it was a gunshot, wasn't sleeping pills or something like that. And I kept being hit with it. And I had to keep going to the Lord about it because I said, this is just so grievous to me. It's so hard, you know, that this is what happened. And one of my comforts actually, again, was Mary, because it hit me, I'm sure it was the Holy Spirit, but it hit me that she had to deal with this in her own son, the violence that was done to him. You know, and in a strange way, it was a comfort because I wasn't alone with it in that sense. Someone else had dealt with this and knew, it's like they knew the pain that I was going through. Father Dan Jones, well, he's my spiritual director, but he had been saying this word to me for years, and he brought it back up to me, and I want to share this with you too, as he kept saying, don't be afraid. I mean, that's John Paul, but he'd say it very specifically. Don't be afraid of the sleeplessness. Don't be afraid of the struggle. Don't be afraid of dealing with this. And I think it was his way of keeping me on the dance floor with the Lord, you know. Don't be afraid of what comes at you in the midst of these hard situations because God's bigger than them. And the only way that I could get through it was by going through it. And by God walking with me through it. And when I would get hit by those times, I would call on the prayers of my friends. In fact, I was rereading some stuff I had written, and one of them was Deacon Steve, because I must have talked to him around that time, and he said he was praying for me. And I remember in the middle of the night just saying, Lord, hear Deacon Steve's prayers. Hear so-and-so's prayers, you know, because I knew those people were praying for me, and it really was a strength for me and made such a big difference. And again, reading the Psalms was also a, just reading through those words that had been written by people who had gone through similar things. Another thing that I think, again, was the Holy Spirit was that I realized that Jesus had a brother who committed suicide because Judas committed suicide. And again, it was just such a comfort to me to know that, you know, there's so many things that I think all of you realize at different times in your own life when you go through these hard things and you see it in God's life, in Christ's life, you know. And I especially thought about Mary and what her grief must have been for Judas. You know, he was one of the apostles, one of Christ's brothers, and you know, she wasn't just gonna, oh, so, you know, he did this. There had to have been a real pain in her over his death as well. And again, that it was a comfort for me to know that. You know, what was her lament through this? Jesus, you know, why did you let this happen, you know? So, okay. I'm not just going to share with you every little detail, obviously, but I wanted to share two other things that I experienced as comfort from the Lord. As well as the violence, the other thing that I really wrestled with was that his body was undiscovered for 10 days, and I just kept thinking about him being alone during that time. And I don't know, it just really bothered me. You know, someone that you... I didn't plan on crying tonight. Why should I not be surprised? But that... I think as women especially, you know, if someone you know dies, you don't want them to be alone, you know. And so quite a few months later, a friend of mine had told me about a series of CDs that she had listened to on angels. And so I started listening to them. And in the course of the talks, this priest shared a story about, which I'm going to share with you, about another priest. And it goes something like this. The priest's mother had died suddenly and unexpectedly one day, collapsing on a street after having gone shopping. And the priest, when he found out about her death, he was able to accept it, you know, peacefully, except for the fact that she had died in public, because his mother was a very private person and would never wanted to die in a public place. And so that was very disturbing to him, you know, that why did God allow that to happen that way? So a few weeks after the funeral, he happened to be in the neighborhood where this shop was, and he stopped in, and the woman who worked there knew him and asked him how he was doing. And so he relayed his concern to her about the circumstances of his mother's death, and she said, "Didn't anyone tell you?" Apparently a young man had been present, had come up to her immediately almost and put his coat around her and then held her in his arms until the EMT folks arrived. Then he helped them get her into the ambulance and took his coat. And so this priest was so grateful because she wasn't alone. And so he wanted to know who that young man was so that he could find him and thank him. And but the woman didn't know, and he kept asking other people around there, "Did you know who that man was?" And they didn't know. And so sometime after that, the priest was praying, and he heard a very distinct voice. I don't know if it was, you know, it's probably internal, but what he heard was, "I am the one you are looking for. I am the guardian angel of your mother." And he realized that this Lord had sent this angel to be with his mother in that space, and I knew right then that someone had been with my brother. He hadn't been alone. And that was such a comfort to me, to know that the Lord showed me that he had someone with him all through that time. He wasn't alone. So, those of you who read my blog know that I love to read Amy Carmichael. Amy Carmichael was a Protestant missionary to India in the, I think, the early 1900s. I'm not good at dates. And she's one that's been kind of an anchor for me all through the years. And one day I came across this passage, and I thought this was written for my brother. And it's written for any of you who have people who have died who you're not sure exactly where they are, and you're wondering, but you know that they were probably seeking God, which I know my brother was seeking God. Maybe not the way that we do, but in a way that God knew he was seeking him. But this was what she wrote. For God sees the whole man, and he has a tender way of looking at the soul at its highest, not its lowest. He does not do as we so often do, misjudge it because of what its diseased mind made its body do in a blind and broken hour. I thought that was my brother. We have to do with a love that can, capital L, that can grasp the poor hands that reach out to him in that darkness. What father would not do that? And he is our father. I found that such a comfort because I thought that's how God the Father looks at any of us, at our highest, not our lowest. And so, of course, in my brother and his diseased, because it was some kind of disease, obviously, mental or whatever, that made him do this, that God is a father who looks at us, and not just those we know, but us too, at our highest, not our lowest. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit more about the rest of the story. I'm not going to take as much time, but it doesn't end with a funeral. I had many more sleepless nights crying. People's lives go back to normal. Yours don't go back to normal. This happened in March. In May, I started fainting, just like that, for no reason at all. I knew it was stress. I mean, I hadn't recovered from my surgery. And then this is just was just a major stress. No doctor would believe me until after the fact, but anyway. It cleared up, you know, eventually, because I got over the stress. But it meant I couldn't drive for 6 months. I would be walking around the house, and all of a sudden I just hit the floor flat on my back because I had about a two-second warning that I was going to pass out. And I read somewhere that if you lie down flat, you can't pass out. And it's true. But one time I was taking a walk in the neighborhood, and I just laid down in the ditch because I didn't want to pass out, but anyway. So that started happening. June, I got hit with all kinds of anger. Sister Ann heard a lot of this anger. I'm sure it had to do with my brother's death, but it was coming out about everything. I was just angry. You know, stuff that had been simmering had just was starting exploding. People were very patient with me through that. Just let me vent. February, 2 weeks before I was supposed to drive again, I broke my right ankle. And I remember I was coming down the stairs for Mass, and I just went, I like to tell people it was something glorious, but I just kind of stepped off too soon, and three steps, and went, you know, down on my right ankle, and I like to say it was in scrimmage football or something, but it wasn't. So I'm lying there going, okay, whatever you want, you know, I don't quite get this, and The whole Servants of God's Love were going to Rome in 3 weeks or something for a pilgrimage because Sister Anne's term of office as superior was ending, and we were having elections for a new superior. And so we were going to go as a way of praying and pilgrimage, and guess who didn't get to go? So not only was I not driving, I couldn't even leave the house hardly because I had a broken ankle. And then they had the audacity to elect me superior. It's not funny. I had been superior the first 10 years. I thought I was done. Anyway, and the elections were supposed to be on March 17th, and God provided for me because I thought, I can't do that. I can't do this on the first anniversary. And Sister Marianne was out east, and a major snowstorm hit out east, so we had to postpone them. So then I became superior. And that's when, you know, that window I told you had kind of closed after about a month. But when I became superior, a door came down. I don't know how to describe it other than that. It's almost like a prison cell, like kaboom. And it surprised me because I really had wrestled with this whole thing of this is a possibility and God knows I don't want it. And this really was a lament for me. I don't want to do this. And I got to the point where I could say, I will do this if you want me to. I don't like being in charge. I like my opinions to be known, but I don't like being in charge. I don't like the buck stopping here all the time. And I don't know if it's a new hymn of darkness or it's still part of the other one, but I've kind of realized it doesn't really matter as long as, again, as I stand on the dance floor, stay on the dance floor. And I'd say, when I say the door came down, it's like, I don't know where God went in a certain way. Like, I experience him helping me lead, but when it comes to the interpersonal relationship, I'm not always sure where he is. And I know it's, you know, I just got to keep wrestling. I'm hoping for the butt part to come pretty soon, that flag, you know, that comes up. But I wanted to share this from another book by Michael Card that actually I just found. It's a sequel to this other one. It's called The Hidden Face of God. And I share this because I hope it brings you hope. Those who are lost in this wilderness of grief, most especially at the loss of a child, have come to know that there is no comfort for what they are experiencing, no mourning at the end of this long, dark night. Theirs is an honest hopelessness that sees with a disturbing clarity through their tears that there is no hope. It simply does not exist anywhere. I mean, your child's not going to come back to you in this life. Neither is there the seed of hope that will ever exist. At this darkest stage, in order for comfort to exist, it must be created out of the nothingness that smothers the sufferer. Comfort ex nihilo, which is to say a comfort that can only come from the God who alone can create something out of nothing. Isn't that beautiful? That's the kind of God we deal with. He can create something out of nothing. Hope where even the possibility of hope does not exist. Comfort for those who are comfortless. For those who in honest hopelessness refuse to be comforted with the pale distractions of this world, the pointless poems, the pious slogans, or the next cure, he comes. The word of comfort, for comforter is one of his names. I want to share that because that's sometimes in the middle of a lament, that's where you hit. You hit bottom, you hit hopelessness, you hit, you know, Job hit bottom. And there's hope because of God who can create out of our nothingness. It's just a beautiful, I found that a very comforting for me right now because I feel like that's kind of where I am, you know. Okay, just want to end with a little bit here. This type of death is what I call, this is my term, a long grief. Like some others, death of a child, I think. Many other things that have been done to you personally, you know. And it keeps resurfacing. And I think untimely deaths especially are like that. They just keep resurfacing. I just read this year, and I think it's... Anyway, I'll read this. According to the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders, the level of stress resulting from the suicide of a loved one is ranked as catastrophic, equivalent to that of a concentration camp experience. And I would say yes to that. And I think other things, it's not just narrowed down to that experience, but it is, there are others that are on that level, but from my own experience, I feel like that, I can really say that's true. And every year around his anniversary, which is this year, you know, it's something comes up, and, you know, I felt pretty steady after I got through that first year, and I thought, I'm going to be okay, and then I hit the second year, and anniversary, and I was, wow, I was just overwhelmed, and last year I was like, okay, I'm going to be fine, it's my third year, you know, and I went to confession with Father Bob, and he said, take off your superior hat and let yourself grieve, and I walked out, and Sister Sarah said, are you okay, and I said, uh-uh, and I just went in the office, my office, and I just started sobbing, you know, it just kind of hits you, you know, it's just one of those things that sticks with you, and so this year I'm just ready for anything, I feel like, you know, but I want to sing this song all the way through. I want to sing this hymn of darkness all the way through to the end because I want God to be glorified through it. So I feel like maybe it's getting to this level, which is again from Michael Card, Grief resolved through lament becomes ballast, settling deep down in our souls. There, like the ballast in a ship, it rights us, keeping us upright in the midst of the typhoons. It is not an accomplishment earned by spiritual exercise, but rather through simple acceptance of the word that speaks, be still. So I'm going to leave you with that. I'm going to leave you with don't be afraid, and also leave you with I've come to know God in a way I never would have if I hadn't walked through this. And I think any of you that are walking through or have walked through these experiences and have met God in it, you know that you know him in a way I would never know the heart of God for people like my brother if I hadn't been in it myself. And so don't be afraid. These two books I'll have across the way if you want to look at either of them. I know Our Lady of Grace is going to have a few copies of this one in, at least the Sacred Sorrow. I didn't ask them for this one because I just discovered it. But you can also get them online, Sacred Sorrow and The Hidden Face of God.